From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Republican Dan Propp, Democrat Dave Lundy, and Scott Hibbard of DePaul University. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. And thank you very much for joining us for this recorded edition of Beyond the Beltway. No phone calls this evening, but we hope that you're going to be with us for the full 2 hours. And thank you very much for being with us as we're going to begin the discussion and the review of 2012. It has been quite a year. Barack Obama has been named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, I think, really to no one's surprise. But there have been other major political issues, including a lot of tragedy related to school shootings, as also as natural disasters as well, that has really helped define 2012. And so we begin tonight, as we generally do when we're in our year-in-review mode, is looking back at that year and talking about the memorable moments, which we will do, and also looking at who the big winners and big losers are. And I begin with Dan Propp. We welcome him. He's our card-carrying Republican tonight. And Dan, first of all, let me congratulate you. You're the new morning man, along with Bruce Wolf, on WLS Radio, and we thank you very much for being here tonight. And again, congratulations
Thank
on
you.
Your new career and
actually,
getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Well,
now.
Yeah, I found out that, you know, even getting up at 3 o'clock, radio is still easier than working for a living. And you introduced me to that. So, no, I appreciate it. Actually, I got my start on Beyond the Beltway. So I owe a lot to you, Bruce, and to Beyond the Beltway for the opportunity to hear from different voices that are otherwise not always heard. And so that's why I love this show so much. And I appreciate what you've done for me personally.
Right. Well, I thank that. And next week, you're going to be sitting in while I'm away on vacation, so you'll be asking the questions. But tonight, my question to you, assuming that, well, first of all, do you agree that Barack Obama is the big winner, or would you like to throw a few more names out there of winners this year?
I think it's hard to look at in politics and say Barack Obama isn't the big winner. And I would say, in addition to that, big government is the big winner. Those two, Barack Obama and big government, I think are almost synonyms now. But I would say that those are the big political winners of the year. Yeah.
Dave Lundy also joins us. Dave, nice to have you with us. A. Laron Communications is where you hang your hat. You're also very active in Democratic politics. What is your, would you, first of all, I assume you agree that Barack Obama is the big winner, but expand that answer if you will.
Well, of course. I mean, President Obama was thought to be a one-termer. It was thought to be that right up until election night by the Romney campaign. So I would agree that the President Obama is the big winner, but I'd actually like to go a little different direction. I think the big winner this year, and it's not something I say with pleasure, are the map makers, those who redraw, who gerrymander districts in state after state around the country. In the Illinois, that benefited the Democrats, but in most states in the country where Republicans won in 2010, they got to redraw the map. And you look at some very strange developments that we're seeing. State of Pennsylvania, Democrats won the congressional vote by over 150,000 votes more than Republican votes. But there are 13 Republican members of the congressional delegation from Pennsylvania and only 5 Democrats. The same is true in Ohio. Similar things are true in Michigan. So I think we've hit a point where gerrymandering has become a real serious problem nationally. And as I said, people in Illinois have been complaining vociferously. Republicans go nuts about, oh, Madigan the map maker. I think it's all bad, and I think we need to evaluate it nationally.
Also joining us tonight is Scott Hibbard. He's a political science professor at DePaul University, one of our new finds this year. Made a number of appearances. Thank you very much.
Great
foreign affairs
back.
Is your area of expertise. Yeah. So my same question to you. Winners, I assume you'd put Barack Obama at the top and expand the list for us.
Yeah, of course. I would also add centrist politics came out ahead in this election. Not to take you with my colleague over there, but if you look at one of the big twists in the election was that the Democrats retained the Senate. And, you know, they were expected to lose the Senate. There were a number of seats that were totally up for grabs. And by overplaying their hand, the Republican Party lost a handful of seats that they should have won. So to me, it wasn't a victory for big government per se. Rather, what it was a victory for centrist politics.
I would just say I think you had some bad candidates lose, and you know the quality of the candidates matters, even in red states like Indiana and Missouri. But one thing in terms of big winners for Republicans, in addition to the obvious one, Speaker Boehner holding the majority in the House, I would say new Republican governors. So had Mitt Romney won, that would preclude the rise of some of the new generation of Republican governors, the Rick Snyders, the Scott Walkers, even the John Kasichs, maybe a Mike Pence in Indiana, Chris Christie. These are people that are going to be very prominent in the 2016 cycle and beyond. And so the Romney loss, not that it was optimal, it certainly wasn't for me, but it does provide opportunity for a new generation of Republican governors, executives to rise in prominence over the next 4 years.
Do you think that did Romney lose it or did Obama win it?
I think Romney largely lost the campaign. It was never his to lose. He had to win it. And I think he failed to do so. I think after the first debate, the seminal moment in for his campaign, the watershed moment where that it all kind of all turned around after he had been languishing from the convention into October. Then after that debate, where everybody agreed he had a tour de force performance, he sat on a lead he didn't have. So it was very curious to me, the Romney campaign. It was very risk-averse, and I don't understand the Republican philosophy, and it persists to this day, and it's not just the Romney campaign, of let's win by retreating. Let's win by not engaging. If the first debate, where you were the proactive participant, was your best moment, then I would think you would want to try and replicate that for the last 3 weeks of the campaign, and he clearly did not do that.
Dave, do you agree with that?
Well, I agree that Romney was an atrociously bad candidate. For the businessman, he ran an atrociously bad campaign. And I don't just mean that in terms of the messaging, which was clearly subpar. I mean that in terms of the consultants.
What was atrocious about it? Just picking up on Dan's point, you agree, because I think you were on the show the week after the debate. I think everyone agreed that he won the debate.
Yes.
So he was an atrocious candidate because he was not able to maintain the momentum that Dan just referenced?
Well, I'll take two parts of that. On the one hand, he was a terrible candidate because it's very hard to be a strong candidate when you flip-flop on all your core positions. American people hate inauthenticity. And Mitt Romney, and it's the same problem that John Kerry had in 2004. It's the same problem that Hillary Clinton had over with Barack Obama in 2008. American people don't like people that they don't trust, and there was just something about that flip-flopping on core issues that was a problem. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the structure of the campaign. I'm talking about some of the overpaid consultants and staff who clearly were outmatched by their Obama counterparts. I'm talking about the get-out-the-vote effort where they constructed this monstrosity of an operation that completely imploded on election day. Mm-hmm. So in instance after instance after instance, the Obama people were really good. I mean, really top of their game good. You're reading about some of the data mining they did. Frankly, as a Democrat, it freaks me out. As a privacy advocate, it really is disturbing how much the Obama people were digging into that. Mm-hmm. But in every respect, the Obama people were out manning the Romney folks.
I want to follow up on that and also talk about foreign affairs and some of the big stories of the year when we continue. Thanks for joining us for this semi-year-end in review. Beyond the Beltway, wherever you're listening from coast to coast and border to border, great to have you with us tonight. Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. To everyone, we were talking about the shift in momentum in the presidential election as we review the events of 2012. Let me ask Dave Lundy, the momentum, the real momentum shift, wasn't it Hurricane Sandy?
No. I reject that. If you look at the data, Romney's high water mark was after the first debate, and he was the gap was going the wrong direction immediately after that. He wasn't able to sustain the momentum, partially for reasons that Dan Prof just articulated.
But he was totally out of the picture. I mean, he wasn't even mentioned in the first two or three stories of the network news.
But it was a continuation of, I mean, his... If you look at just the numbers, the national polling, where things went in the national polling and some of the state-by-state polling, there was a very continual trend line that was not interrupted by Hurricane Sandy. I mean, I won't disagree that there any hope of a resurrection was hurt by Sandy. But the idea that Sandy fundamentally changed the dynamic of the campaign, I just don't agree with at all.
I don't know if you could say that definitively. Dave may be right. I'm not sure. But what we do know, and Nate Silver from 538 blog, New York Times, who predicted 50 of 50 states, so he gets the gold star award. He's a big winner, too, in terms of political prognosticators and pollsters. But he had the coverage of Sandy in that week giving Obama about a point and a half bump. And when you lose by effectively about 330,000 votes spread over a half a dozen states, it could have been impactful. Was it determinative? I think it's difficult to say.
Benghazi was also one of the big, big stories of the year. I know we're going to talk about Syria and Egypt and what was going on there, but let's talk about Benghazi. Are you satisfied with the recent report that came out and laying blame where it should be?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I've always said that it was more of a tragedy than a conspiracy. And we talked about this earlier on your show. You know, what happened was a tragedy. There's no two ways about it. It wasn't a cover-up. Susan Rice, you know, was relaying information that she was told by the CIA. The whole, you know, situation was unfortunate. I think if you really dig into it, I think what we'll probably find out is, you know, in some of the classified materials, there was a lot going on in that consulate that, that you know, drew attention to it. And if we can believe David Petraeus's mistress, you know, we had special forces operating out of there. So... it doesn't overlook the larger issue of, you know, there was a shortage of security. And, you know, then those kinds of decisions are made at mid-level State Department.
Do you really believe that Hillary Clinton was not medically sound enough to appear?
You know, I give her the benefit of the doubt on that.
You do?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's nobody really wanted to get out front on the Benghazi issue, which is one of the reasons Susan Rice was actually, you know, attending doing the morning shows and not the head of the CIA or you know the Secretary of State. But you know, at the end of the day, again, it's you know, it's a tragedy. It wasn't it's not a conspiracy.
Dan, what's your reaction to?
Well, on Hillary Clinton,
the concussion of the Secretary of State and her inability to appear.
I'm willing to give her the benefit of the doubt as long as after her service ends the end of the year that she comes back and testifies, which she said she will do. So if she does that, then fine. But let me say something else on Benghazi. We spoke with Catherine Herridge of the Fox News Channel about this report after this report came out. And, you know, she makes the important point that there's one thing with respect to the compound, and then there's another thing with respect to CIA operations in Benghazi. And whatever the CIA operation was or was not, that was scrubbed and that was off the grid 12 hours after the compound was under siege and those individuals were tragically killed. They never scrubbed or secured that compound. I mean, you had reporters from Foreign Affairs magazine going into the rubble of the compound 8 weeks after the attack, picking up documentation cables between the Ambassador Stevens and his political affairs person. So I think there is more than just a tragedy here. I think there is competency questions that extend beyond the typical mid-level fall guys at the State Department. And I think there are a lot more questions to be asked, in part because we don't know. There are still investigations ongoing. There's still the criminal prosecution, and we haven't had access to the people that have been detained in places like Tunisia with respect to this attack. So I'm not sure this is going to be nicely wrapped up by the end of the year. I think these hearings are going to extend into the new year, and there's more information to be called.
Let me throw a point in here. One of the things that I think this overlooks, and this is what really got me about the Daryl Issa hearings, is that the State Department has been systematically underfunded for about the last 20 years. I mean, defense has more than money than it can spend, but you know, state and AID have been systematically underfunded. They're operating within an environment where they don't have funding for security, and they're scrambling to get that. So when you go after the State Department for not having enough security there, you have to, you know, put it in the broader context.
And I just, you know, I have to say that we're now finally getting to the real questions that should have been asked all along on Benghazi. I think in the immediate aftermath of Benghazi, what was done by Republicans, the Fox News Channel, Senator McCain, Graham, was there was an attempt to scapegoat Susan Rice because they wanted John Kerry as Secretary of State and not Susan Rice. The questions that were being asked about what did she know, why did she say this, those weren't the legitimate questions. Those weren't real. I mean, those are little questions. You're accusing somebody of being a bad spokesperson. The real questions, the important questions were, why wasn't there enough security? What took place in the embassy, in the consulate? Who knew what, when, and why were things not done differently? I mean, I think that these security questions are fundamentally
you're not going to ask them on the first Sunday show after the attack. I mean, those are all legitimate questions. I agree that there's two separate issues.
Yeah, but they spent 6 weeks attacking Susan Rice for being a bad spokesperson.
Well, it wasn't just Susan Rice. I mean, there were questions asked about the Obama administration, and now in the light of this report, even Chris Matthews is saying, well, the administration looks like they knew more than they were letting on. It, you know, the report says quite clearly, no, YouTube video, no. The report says quite clearly there was not a protest that turned into an attack. That was not true. And so and we still don't know who authored those talking points that Susan Rice allegedly relied on.
But
so those are important questions.
The White House changed the word, though.
But let's back up a minute. If in fact, special forces were operating out of that consulate, and if, in fact, again, according to David Price's mistress, we were actually holding people there, then that's a very, very sensitive political issue because that's a violation of their territorial integrity. They're not supposed to be doing that. And you can see why the official statement might have been what it was, not so much because they're trying to lie to the American public, but because they're trying to defend American interests overseas.
Well, that's interesting. Would you say the same thing about Nixon's secret bombings in Cambodia and Laos?
Those were war crimes.
Okay. So lying to the American people about doing something allegedly potentially untoward, inappropriate is okay here, but it's not okay
no,
there.
Bush and Cheney lied to the American people, but Obama.
There's another great example.
Susan Rice did not go on Meet the Press to justify an invasion of an oil-rich Arab state.
Look. I think
what did Colin Powell do at the UN? Was he also just part of that conspiracy?
I think that he was giving bad information.
I think that there's
like
some real
the people
interesting,
we like. We don't like the people. We
no,
don't
No, there's
like.
Some real interesting commonalities between what Colin Powell did at the UN and what Susan Rice did on the Sunday morning talk shows.
That's right.
But we're getting a little bit off topic here of what happened in Benghazi. What does it mean for our security? And the funding questions that you're raising are absolutely legitimate. All the Republicans who were attacking were the ones who were first out front.
You mentioned his name a couple of times. Would everyone agree that David Petraeus is the big loser of the year, David?
Oh gosh, there's so many losers in 2012.
He's a big loser.
Put the list.
I mean, I'd put Grover Norquist on that list. Grover Norquist, who was this big scary guy right up until the moment that he wasn't and decided that a tax increase on people over $1 million isn't a tax increase. But yes, clearly, when you look at where David Petraeus was thought of in our national dialogue versus where he is today, it's hard to come up with a bigger fall.
Well, I think the Norquist thing, I think that's an open question. We'll see for Republicans who vote for a fiscal cliff deal that raises rates or that vote to raise taxes more generally, because there's more to come in this administration over the next 4 years. We'll see how the reckoning at the polls. We'll see what happens. So I wouldn't write Grover Norquist and the kind of anti-tax fervor in this country off so quickly. But, I mean, the big losers, Petraeus, I agree, Mitt Romney is the other obvious one. I also think a big loser are Republicans who think you can argue strictly about marginal tax rates and unfunded liabilities and think you're going to captivate the imagination of the American public. I think the Republican Party that is afraid to talk in the language of values, that's a big loser too.
Well, and I think the Republican Party that just nominated, with all due respect, it's not just about Missouri and Indiana. North Dakota, Heidi Heitkamp won in North Dakota in a state that Barack Obama lost by 20-some-odd points. All throughout the country, Democrats beat the pants off Republicans that had no expectation and no business of winning. There is
a
problem.
Side.
on the Senate side. There is a problem on ungerrymandered districts, the Senate side. There is a problem with the right wing of the Republican Party that is taking absolutist positions and is losing. And I think that
so you
that
– the Tea Party is a big loser.
Yeah. Was a big loser.
I would agree with that.
Who else?
Well, I mean, I think David Treyas, it's a sad state of affairs. I mean, he had a very illustrious career, and it ended in a very ignoble manner. And so I see that as a big loser.
Who are the losers on the world stage?
The Assad regime. They got one foot in the grave, and they're the big losers on that front. I'm hesitant to make a firm statement on this, but the secular liberal forces in Egypt were also losers this year. They got trounced in the presidential election and the parliamentary elections. They've got a ways to go to come back.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big losers, the big story for in the foreign arena for much of the year was the so-called Arab Spring, with dictators being deposed, Gaddafi and Mubarak, and Assad looks like he's on his way out imminently, Tunisia as well. And that Arab Spring about some kind of a stable, not necessarily democratic, but stable, more pluralistic societies that would be forthcoming. Doesn't look like it's working out so much.
Well, it's a little early.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a little early to pass judgment.
Not too early for us to say that we're going to pause for a few moments, and we thank you very much for joining us for this 2012 Year in Review show. Thanks for being with us tonight from coast to coast and border to border. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us this evening. Around the table tonight, we have Scott Hibbard. He is a political science professor at DePaul University, specializing in international affairs. Also joining us this evening is Dan Proft. He is a conservative commentator. He's also the new morning man along with Bruce Wolf on our flagship station WLS 890 in Chicago, and also ran for governor of Illinois in a primary recently. And also joining us this evening is Dave Lundy. He is the president of Aileron Communications, and he's been active in Democratic Party politics for a long time. And he's been looking deep into the numbers. And as we speak tonight, on the 23rd of December, they're still counting votes. What's taking them so long?
And does Romney have a chance?
Are there any pockets anywhere that Romney can pray for?
He could pray, and given how bad his numbers guys messed it up, he may believe he has a chance. But I'm pretty convinced it's done. What's fascinating is since Election Day, there have been about 8 or 9 million votes cast, and so now you're within, I think, 2 or 3 million votes of the number that were cast in 2012. Barack Obama's lead continues to grow. He's now up by more than 5 million votes. You're looking at a 51-47. Of course, we on the left all appreciate the poetry of Mitt Romney getting 47 percent. And it's fascinating to see this wasn't a close election. And Barack Obama's become only the fifth president in American history to get more than 51% two elections. Democrat, Republican, the first Democrat to do it since Roosevelt, the first president to do it since Reagan. It's really it was a very decisive victory. This is not an accidental president.
Well, I know that. And Mitch McConnell, I don't know if you heard his comment today. He is determined to make Barack Obama a two-term president.
And that's one promise Mitch McConnell will actually keep.
Is there some way that – I mean, that is rather staggering that so many votes have been counted since Election Day. Is there some way – I mean, every single election night – as I'm looking at these results, I'm saying, why are we waiting for this precinct to come in? Why are we still screwing up? Why are we worrying about, ballots in Florida or, ballots in Ohio? I mean, isn't there a better way that this, great nation should be running our elections?
Well, there is. I mean, and frankly, if Illinois were more competitive, we'd probably be talking about Cook County, Illinois, as much as we'd be talking about any county in Florida in terms of the administration of elections. But these are very local matters. They're state and local matters. And so, every county is its sovereign enterprise when it comes to how elections are conducted in many ways. But I agree with you. I mean, I think that the idea that 9 million votes have been cast or have been counted, excuse me, since November 6th, Dave Lundy may be the only one who's paying attention to the ongoing count. But that's a travesty. I mean, that stuff should be known on election night or the next day. And so I think there are issues with maybe changing deadlines, as we were talking about off air, about absentee ballot applications and so forth.
But lest any of your viewers or listeners think there's some Democratic conspiracy here, this is not unusual. This is what happens every election cycle.
I know.
You have millions and millions.
We should be able to get our act together.
We should be able
especially
to.
Especially with technology.
And if you and look, there is a constitutional problem here, because generally speaking, other than the Bush v. Gore decision in 2000, federal courts are loath to interfere with elections. It is a local matter. It is administered by states. What would really be helpful and, frankly, required if you want to fix this problem are national standards for voting, a national administrative standards. And you're not going to get that, because the truth is that somebody is always going to be on the winning side of those bad election practices. And those are the people who are in power, and they're not going to want to change it.
Scott? Yeah. I was going to say the same thing. You know, there are some simple reforms that could be done, both in terms of redrawing districts as well as, you know, running elections. And both of those things would address the issues that were raised earlier, both in terms of gerrymandering as well as, you know, making the elections run a little more smoothly.
As we, you know, we've talked about the election, obviously, the general election. But as you look back on the primary process, are you satisfied with the primary process, Dan, that it takes a long time, it allows someone to stumble, get back on their feet, the numerous debates? I think we had more debates than we've ever had. So is the general public more informed about the candidates? And are you generally pleased with sort of the process this year?
Yeah, I mean, look, I have no problem with the primary. I know some Republicans say, oh, these primaries, and they're so divisive, and you have seven candidates, and they're all carving each other up. You know, that's what should happen. This is a vetting process. And so I more debates, more opportunities for more expansive views of candidates, you know, kicking the tires three times before you decide who you're going to vote for. I think that's a good thing. So provide as many opportunities as possible for people who want to be informed about candidates, who want to be informed about issue positions, to be informed about them. And, you know, I don't think Mitt Romney lost the election because he had a difficult primary. I think the difficult primary made him a better candidate. If he would have had a walk, he would have been even a worse candidate than he was. You have to be battle tested in this arena. And frankly,
although he was severely savaged by Newt Gingrich by bringing up Bain Capital and by bringing up the issue of his success, which the Obama campaign clearly had in their bag of tricks and they were going to use. I mean, the fact that ammunition was fired early in the campaign, I mean, Romney was pretty bloodied by that, even though he won the primary.
Well, yeah, but two things I'd say to that. One is that redounded to the detriment of Newt Gingrich.
Yes.
When he called him a voucher capitalist. That marginalized Newt Gingrich, as it should have. And the second thing
now
I would say—
Now it's made him a media darling. He's going to be the favorite Republican candidate all over TV.
Yeah, well—
Because the national media loves Republicans that turn on Republicans.
Totally, totally. I agree. That's why they liked McCain so much in 2008
right.
Until he was up against Obama. But the other thing I would say is it also took that issue off the table. You're right, the Obama campaign had that, but then Bain Capital wasn't part of their real attack on Mitt Romney. I mean, it was kind of implicitly with the rich guy kind of class envy stuff, but Barack Obama didn't bring up Bain Capital in any of the debates because the issue had been kind of addressed and it had become passé. So I think you can look at that and say, look, all of these issues get fleshed out in more detail and it takes some ammunition away from your opponent in the general election because you've had time to address it over and over and over again.
Yeah, I strongly disagree with that. It was not a national issue. Bain Capital was not a national issue. But Bain Capital was a critical issue that the Obama campaign used to great effect in the swing states to really create, to win more working class white voters, in Ohio in particular. Had they not launched the attacks they did on Romney over Bain Capital in the state of Ohio in the summer months, I'm not convinced Barack Obama wins Ohio.
Well, and the auto bailout.
The auto bailout
sunk him in Ohio.
Two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. The one thing about the primary I would say, though, too, and this is really an indictment of our campaign finance laws more so than having a robust primary, but Mitt Romney had to spend a lot more than I think he wanted to spend. And so during those summer months when Barack Obama was up with $150 million in ad buys in swing states and Mitt Romney was kind of waiting for his money to come in, that he could use pursuant to FEC laws, that I think was a kind of a strategic challenge that he had because of that primary.
Yeah.
And this is where I'd go back to the original question that Bruce raised. Is this process too long? And I would say it's definitely too long. The campaigns are already starting for 2014 and 2016. People are raising money. Every member of Congress is building a war chest. I mean, it really is out of control. If I had my druthers, I'd go to an English system. You call the election. 5 weeks later, you hold it.
But if you did that,
it's not going to happen. But
in 5 weeks, you don't have a chance to really know a candidate. You don't have an opportunity to find out how they react when they stub their toe. I mean, in every campaign that you can remember, I mean, even in Obama's campaign, you had the Reverend Wright issue. You want to see how people respond.
Yeah, but
you want to see how they manage their campaign.
In a five-week campaign, Barack Obama would have never been president.
I remember Mitt Romney giving a speech in 2008 at the close of the campaign when he was already out of the game. And all I kept thinking is he's running for 2012. It's starting right now, and it's just that perpetual cycle.
But Bruce, I could not agree with you more about your point, because if you look back in time,
would you repeat that again?
Bruce, you are right. If you look back in time, if we had that system, a 5-week campaign, Ross Perot would have been president. Yep. Would anybody sitting at this table argue that Ross Perot, that fella would have been a great president of the United States? I mean, it takes time to expose candidates' weaknesses and candidates' nuances, and I agree with you. Congressional campaigns are too long because they start the moment you're elected and they keep going and they never stop. But the Republican the primary system for president, I think, is critical to really having an understanding who an individual is.
And the issue of money in politics too, because I know this is one of these things that people often talk about. Oh, there's so much money, they spend so much. And look, the Institute for Justice, a public interest law firm in D.C., I think has the definitive aphorism on this. There's not too much money in politics. There's too much government for sale. So there's so much money in politics because government is so big and so expansive and has so many goodies to hand out. And so money flows in that direction because there's a lot at stake and there's a lot of to procure. So if you really want to reduce the money and the influence in government, reduce the size and scope of government.
I would argue that part of the problem is also this, that the access to the airwaves, which is what costs so much money, is part of the problem. And that if you could make provide free access to the airwaves for presidential candidates, for congressional candidates, you would greatly diminish the cost of campaigns, and that would address some of the demand side of the fundraising.
Communications are expensive. As a communications consultant, I appreciate that. But as as somebody who cares about the American political process, I think that the unregulated, large, anonymous gifts to the 501c4s like Crossroads GPS, the Sheldon Adelson putting $100 million so that his thumb is much heavier on the scale, I think that's where the real problem is.
Yeah, but he didn't win.
Yeah, the cure.
I didn't say he was competent with his money, but
he did shape the frame of debate.
That's true. 1-800-723-8289, that's the phone number, but don't call it tonight. Don't call it tonight. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. And we've been talking about, obviously, the big stories of the year. We've focused on the campaign and the winners and the losers. But I think everyone would agree that putting even the election aside and Barack Obama's being named the Time Man of the Year, I think everyone sort of agrees with that. But certainly the events of the last couple of weeks have really focused attention on what I think is probably the most devastating and story of the year, and that is the tragic shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut. And the president went on the air earlier this week and addressed some of the things, some of the changes that he wants to see happen. And he's appointed Vice President Biden to look into a way in which he can bring a number of cabinet officers together to come up with a game plan on how to address some of these issues. Dan, what's your take on where this story goes and the impact of this, on the body politic, not just on our elective politics?
Well, the impact, of course, is substantial. I mean, especially only a few months after the shooting at the theater in Aurora, Colorado. And, you know, I think I think, of course, the politicians are rushing to capitalize on this, or even not necessarily capitalize, that's too cynical, but to kind of do something, to feel like they're doing something, even if it's well-intentioned, but it will have very limited impact and positive impact, which I think is the road that the president is going down. But I think the larger question that has to be asked is, you know, what evil lies in man's heart that would drive someone to execute five-year-olds? And that's a question that there are inadequate answers to, but it doesn't mean that's the question we shouldn't ask and search for answers, as opposed to asking less important questions and providing inadequate answers to those questions. I think there is a discussion that needs to be had over in this country about evil versus the instrumentality of evil. Jim Jones used poison. The 9/11 terrorists used box cutters and airplanes. There are various instrumentalities for evil, but the question is evil or people that are mentally ill, and what we're doing to provide support, particularly to families that have a person that is mentally ill and are kind of crying out for assistance beyond their capacity and not getting that assistance. I think that's the more important discussion.
Dave Lundy.
I agree with with part of what Dan said. Clearly, this is a matter of evil. It's a matter of mental illness. You need a comprehensive look at what's really going on here. I have to say, as the father of a 7-year-old and a 2-year-old, every day has been an emotional. I mean, it's so devastating to watch this. No story has ever touched me like this one, and I think that's what's happened with elected officials around the country. I think that, you know, most of them are parents, and they're mostly looking at what's going on here and looking at their own kids and going, how can I let this continue without trying to do something? That having been said, I think that you look at evil, mental illness, plus easy access to military style weapons with large magazines. You cannot divorce them. You know, if you don't have access and you have evil, you have a terrible incident like what happened in China on the same day, where a Chinese man attacked an elementary school with a knife, attacked 22 kids,
right.
Nobody dead. You cannot look at the lethality of these instances and not say we need to at least address that as an issue. And it's not what the framers of the Constitution intended with the Second Amendment.
I definitely agree with that. And I also think the one thing that I applaud the president on, first of all, I said last week on the broadcast that I thought that his speech or his comments to the nation immediately following the tragedy, I thought were well stated as both a husband, as a father, and as the president of the United States. I thought and going to the public memorial service. But the thing I enjoyed about the speech, and I anticipated and I suggested last week on the program that obviously the media was going to gravitate almost exclusively to an issue of gun control, and they did. It was obvious. But some of the broader discussions that were going on, I think, put things in context, and I think the president even put it in context with his remarks. It is about gun control. It's about mental health. It's about cultural insensitivity. It's about a variety of things. And what the vice president has been given is to look at the totality of the issue. And I hope that for political purposes, he just doesn't focus on the guns. Because whereas I agree with you that there are too many guns and access to guns is for the wrong people is not a good thing, in this particular case, it would not have stopped this crime, because the weapons were there, they were in the home, they were legally in the home as far as we know. But the common denominator on all these shootings is mental health. Mental health, even more than guns, Scott.
I mean, there are definitely two sides of it. I'm happy that they're going to be looking into some of these cultural issues, because, you know, the pervasiveness of these violent video games and all that is certainly a part of the issue. And the cultural issues is definitely a side of it. But, you know, as a society, we have a real problem with weaponry. And if you look at the statistics, you know, we have close to 10,000 deaths a year through gun violence. Mexico has about 11,000 because they get a lot of the heavy weaponry, or the drug gangs get a lot of heavy weaponry from the U.S. No other society has those kinds of stats. I mean, even Germany, which has a high death rate from firearms vis-a-vis the rest of Europe has 148 deaths a year. There are some very simple things we can do to tighten up the gun laws, close certain loopholes regarding the gun shows, having more extensive background checks. I mean, there are things that can be done to tighten up the loopholes without infringing upon people's constitutional rights.
I say again, you know, McVeigh used fertilizer. If their guns were not accessible, maybe Lanza uses a kerosene bomb. I don't know, but it's not the key question. And we know it's not the key question because we have 49 states that provide some form of right to carry weapons for law-abiding citizens. And the interesting thing about that is a study by John Lott, University of Chicago, finds that persons with right to carry permits starting in Florida 25-plus years ago have a lower incidence of the commission of crimes than do police officers. So I think that you need to be very careful in terms of how we examine this debate about the instrumentality versus law-abiding and people with mental illness issues.
Dan Proft, I thank you very much for being with us. He's the new morning man on WLS, our flagship station in Chicago. Also, Dave Lundy from Aileron Communications, Scott Hibbert from DePaul University. They have joined us this week on Beyond the Beltway. If you're watching us on television, we are going to see you next week. And if you're listening to us on radio, we'll be back with another full hour of your interest and a new panel of guests when we roll on radio. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Republicans Stephanie Hitt, Democrat Richard Boykin, Mike Miller of DePaul University, and Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago. Our program tonight, coming from my home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Great to have you with us for this recorded edition of Beyond the Beltway. No phone calls tonight as we continue to review the events of 2012. We've got a new panel to discuss that. And joining us tonight, I want to turn to one of our card-carrying Republicans, and that is Stephanie Hitt. Stephanie, Time Magazine has voted Barack Obama the man of the year, the winner of the year, obviously. Person of the year, I guess they're now referring to it. I would assume you agree with that, but is there anyone else that you would put up there as a winner this year politically?
You know, I think definitely, well, you know, I was kind of thinking they might do Sandra Fluke, and this is my impression on Time of the Year. I think it represents maybe not the best that America has to say about itself, but pretty much what typifies what's going on in the culture today. And when I heard that her name was nominated, I thought, what better way to represent what I think is probably some of the biggest errors of the year, and that is the so-called war on women.
Who's the biggest loser of the year, in your view?
Other than the American public, I think probably right now, I'd say the Republican Congress, as we're facing the fiscal cliff.
All right, let's go to Richard Boykin, our card-carrying Democrat. The winner of the year and the loser of the year, insofar as you're concerned, Richard.
Well, look, I think that Time magazine had it right. I think that President Obama is certainly the person of the year. He's the winner. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at it, and I also would say that the American people are winners in terms of universal health care. I mean, it's an issue that nobody really anticipated that the conservative court would actually uphold, but they upheld it. And so, you know, I mean, I think he's done something that no other president has been able to do in the history of this democracy. And so I think he's the winner. I think the American people are winners. And, of course, we had a big election. And, you know,
She thinks the American people were losers. I want to get Stephanie to respond to that, but Mike Miller of DePaul University also joins us. He weighs in from the right of the center, usually.
Sure. I think that the choice was fine, but if you wanted another choice, somebody who I think was very influential and did a lot would be Angela Merkel of Germany. I think Europe would have been in really big trouble had Merkel not stood up to Europe and said, we've got to get things under control, and I'll do what I can, but I can't do everything. So I thought she was wonderful. I think that would have, in a normal year, if this wasn't the election year where Obama was reelected, mm-hmm. I think she should have gotten it. In terms of loser, I want to think of it not as a loser, but as someone who has unfortunately lost in the sense of the long-term unemployed of the United States. We continue with the weakest recovery on record. Unemployment at rates we have not seen this long after a recession is over ever since the Great Depression. And those long-term unemployed just see no light at the end of the tunnel. And I think in terms of somebody who has lost, who has really hurt this year, that's the group of people that has hurt the most.
Charles Lipson, winners and losers.
These are really fascinating answers. I've been doing reports, a fair number, actually, for Fox Business Network on the European financial crisis. So Mike's point about Angela Merkel is well taken. I think that President Obama being reelected with the kind of unemployment that there is in this country is really a stunning achievement. The bottom line is that we're basically back where we were. That is, we still have a Republican Congress. We still have a Democratic Senate. We still have the president, who I think will get Supreme Court appointments. I think that the health care issue actually is going to be a big deal over the next year, and I look forward to talking with Richard about that. I think as you look around the world, you mostly see problems. That is, you see problems in North Korea, you see problems in Iran, you see the Arab Spring turning into a winter, you see an awful civil war in Syria, you see Egypt turning Islamicist. It's really hard to look around the world and find somebody who really represents a shining star.
Stephanie, you said you thought the American people were losers. Expand on that.
Well, I think that, not that we're losers, but that we've lost. We're and that is... Again, I think exactly what Charlie was saying is I personally believe that we elected the brand of Barack Obama, and that somehow transpired. It transcended all of the problems, the worst economy, the unemployment, the disasters in the Middle East, all of those things were transcended by this man with some ethereal promise. And
no, but he also had a very specific promise. He said that people who made more than $250,000 a year were not paying their fair share, and he won, and he won handily. He won by over 5 million votes. That's there's little right. County votes. So he won handily. So so shouldn't people who make over $250,000, shouldn't they be prepared to pay more, even though the fiscal cliff, the figure is much higher than that at the moment?
He won handily, but some other group also won with a majority, and that was the Republican promise, the Republican Congress. And I think what Americans voted for was more of the same. Well, because if they want it, they know that the Republican Congress is a check,
Richard,
on
you,
that, and they control the budget.
You totally disagree with what
you
just said.
Yes, I disagree in a sense, because Democrats actually picked up 9 seats in the House of Representatives. So, I mean, they're marching closer towards the leadership in the House. And I think that the president, he was dealt a bad hand. I mean, and he's done. Look, he winded down the war. In Iraq, he's winding down the war in Afghanistan. We're going to have savings there. I mean, these weren't his wars, but he's winding down both of them and, you know, ending them. And, I mean, he brought health care, and he's doing the best that he can with the circumstances that he was facing.
What can you speak about Mike's point about the unemployed, though? Is I guess this flew in the face of all the political axioms, and that is, if the economy is bad, people are not going to reelect the president. Why is this an exception to that political rule, in your view?
Well, I think that a lot of it has to do with who was on the other side. Mm-hmm. I think if the people felt like they had a real choice. I mean, the gentleman who was on the other side, he wrote off 47%.
That was
of
one
America.
Of the most important quotes. You were so right. One of the most important, quote of the year, wouldn't you say, Richard?
Yeah, I mean, one of them. I mean, he wrote off 47% of Americans and said that pretty much they were going to vote for the other guy. And then, you know, to add insult to injury, he came back and said after the president won, The president won because he gave these guys gifts. He gave African Americans gifts. He gave Hispanics gifts. So really in a time
but
where
there
you
was,
ought to be
but,
a bridge
but there was truth to that, wasn't there?
No, not really.
Wasn't
look,
there truth?
Look, I think that the president actually built bridges. I think that when you look at his win, you look at the coalition that he put together. You look at the Hispanics. You look at the African Americans. People said that they wouldn't come out and vote in the numbers that they came out in 2008.
Richard, I can just tell the Republicans. The table almost shifted when you were talking. We do have to pause. Our Republicans are going to have 3 whole minutes to figure out what happens next. Thanks very much for joining us on this year in review of edition of Beyond the Beltway. Nice to have you with us tonight. From coast to coast and border to border, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. In the last segment, our Democrat Richard Boykin made some comments about President Obama building bridges to all kinds of constituencies, and the Republican side of our table tonight, they were like chomping at the bit. So, Mike Miller, we'll let you start. Building bridges?
No, the man has many talents. He's a very bright man. He charismatic personality. He gets people to follow him. But building bridges, I don't see it at all. Within academia, even, everything is so petty and so small. But one of the ways that you get faculty to do things, good administrators are people who can build these coalitions and groups of people, and they all want to do things together. He never can do that. Of all the things you want to say about him, that's the one thing he cannot do. He just cannot
do. Well, I mean, for 3 years in a row, I mean, one of the reasons we're at this fiscal cliff is for 3 years in a row, Republicans, presented a budget that and Democrats as well that, they all voted against whatever Obama was presenting. He has not found a way to reach across the political aisle. He may be able to reach into different neighborhoods and different groups and different factions. And I will give you this. He has an amazing gift to appeal to a lot of people. But I go back to my original statement. It is a brand. It's superficial. It supersedes reality.
Is there at this moment, as we look ahead to 2013, in the wake of one of the most significant tragedies, certainly of the last 50 years in the country, and that is the Sandy Hook Elementary shooting, is there a mindset in the country where all sides can get together and come up with comprehensive resolution that deals with both some gun control, which the president addressed in his speech, some issues of mental health, some issues of cultural reforming, some cultural mindsets or insensitivities that we have in the country? Is there something that Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives can agree on? Charles.
I think there is.
And what would it be? Where would you start?
I think that what will be required is some very senior Republicans to say that assault weapons need to be regulated, as Ronald Reagan did earlier. I think that's the place you start. I think the longer you wait on this, the more that possibility of a coalition falls apart. Let me say two things about building bridges. The first I would say is that if you look at President Obama's major achievements, and in particular at the stimulus bill and health care, what you see is that those were pushed through without bipartisan support. And in the case of health care, it was the only really large-scale social reform we've had in America, at least in the last 100 years, that hasn't had bipartisan support. So I think that the record of building those bridges, I'm not saying whether it's President Obama's fault, whether it's the fault of the other side, but the fact is they have not been bipartisan. Second point has to do with taxing the wealthy. I think that President Obama has the cards on that. I think that will happen. In fact, you've seen Boehner cave on that. I just think that's going to happen. But that's not the problem. It is all symbolic politics. It won't raise very much money. And the big problem over the last 4.5 years has been a vast growth of expenditures. If those are not controlled, we just won't get
I want to give people a chance to respond to that, but I want to stick to my question, and that is, in the wake of the Sandy Hook tragedy, is there a moment where Congress can come together and do something in a comprehensive way so that Democrats don't believe that or Republicans don't believe that they're being asked to walk the walk and take the pill with gun control, and the Democrats understand that they've got to expand on some issues as well? Look, a way to do it. By the way, you're the former chief of staff to right. Congressman Danny K. Davis, longtime Democrat from the west side of Chicago.
Who I might add, Bruce, is now back on Ways and Means, and we're excited about that because we need tax reform in order to get some additional revenues in. But let me say, to answer your question, absolutely, yes, we can come together. I think that you'll see, this panel that is being headed by Vice President Biden. I think that you'll see them come out with some recommendations. Obviously, one of them is going to be, let's renew the ban on assault weapons. We don't need assault weapons. And I think that I also think that the NRA has softened its position relative to what happened.
But what are they going to do? What are they going to do? And I want the Republicans to comment on this. Because the other thing, and again, I congratulate the president because he talked about gun control, he talked about mental health, and he also talked about cultural issues. What's going to happen on the mental health side? What's going to happen on the cultural side? Because those, in my view, those are every bit as important as clamping down on some of the prevalence and the availability of guns.
I absolutely agree. You come up with some kind of comprehensive thing on gun control. All you have to do is look at the research, and the research shows it really doesn't work. There's nothing you can do. We had an assault weapons ban, if you would define it properly, and it didn't do anything. In terms of cultural things, though, I think that – how come years ago when I was a child, my father-in-law told me that he was in education. They had a gun club. Students would bring guns to school, and they would shoot after school, and they had a very good gun team and so forth. Why weren't they killing each other? The guns were there. They were perfectly available. It's a cultural thing.
And people were mentally ill then.
And of course they were, of course. But many of them, of course, of the what you would call violently mentally ill, and only a very small percentage of mentally ill people are violent, they were put away. And now you can't easily put them away.
Stephanie.
Well, you know, Bruce, you're right to be concerned about whether or not a comprehensive solution can be built. And I'm very concerned because we just recently had a presidential press conference where he introduced Joe Biden, Vice President Biden, as the head of this new commission. And in outlining the commission, spent 90% of the time talking about guns. Guns is the problem. Guns is gun control. And the more and more we look through, guns were the means. But when we delve through these massacres, these disasters, we see the common thread are these mental health issues and the cultural issues, whether it's videos, movies, games, and parenting and those kinds of life issues. The point is, I don't see how in setting up the framework, the president has built in the right areas and the right focus on this. And that's what bothers me.
He's got one focus
on it, and it's right. singular. That's disturbing. And, you know, Vice President Biden, he has a history of going for gun control. And that's his strength.
Well, that's what
his
I see.
His mental health history.
That's what I want to see. I want to see, to me, that the president's rhetoric in his speech – has got to go beyond rhetoric. Yeah. If he is a Johnny One Note just on guns, then I won't take the president as being very serious. I was very satisfied when in his address immediately after the shooting, and he talked about all the devastation and an unwanted murder that was going on in the country. I was very glad that he mentioned the violent streets of Chicago. And you've heard me say this on this program. I think that he, frankly, has missed an opportunity as the president of the United States, to use the bully pulpit and to use his sway within cultural America to have some impact on the violence in video games. Many of those from Hollywood are huge supporters of his. And he's got to bring the leaders of motion pictures together and the gaming industry together, because they have a responsibility for feeding sick minds. Now you've got to deal with the mental health issue. And that broadens that. And by the way, this is something where the Republicans are going to have to, you know, open up their eyes. I mean, you know, to me, to have a mental health and to have a health care program in the country that does not include mental health, it's time for us to think seriously about that. I would rather have them spend more time thinking about how to deal with that. And you know what? It's going to cost money to do it. But that is going to have a far greater impact, because the people that are literally trapped in their homes, they don't know what to do with their children. They know they're going in the wrong direction. They can't find a place to get help for them. And again, insurance does not cover mental health. And that's ridiculous in the alleged greatest country in the world. Charles.
Well, you know, it's not just that there was the shooting in Connecticut. It was that there was the earlier shooting in Colorado. There were the shootings at Virginia Tech. There were the shootings that the president declined to mention at Fort Hood. This is something that this kind of broke the camel's back. Let me say, it is not simply a partisan issue either. When the Democrats had complete control of the Congress, Nancy Pelosi did not push anything on this, and there's a reason for that. There are a lot of people, including, for example, in the communities that are most overrun by guns and gangs, where a lot of the kind of responsible people living in their house and they're 75 years old actually want something to protect themselves.
Right.
I've seen those people talking, and they feel like what would happen is that they would be disarmed because they're law-abiding people, but that the bad folks with the guns would still have them. So it's a hard issue. You're absolutely right about the mental health side. Bruce.
One of the things, Bruce, that I hope that Republicans and Democrats can come together on, I think we need to bring prayer back in the schools. I mean, they pray before every session of the United States Congress, the Supreme Court, the Senate, here in the state of Illinois, every legislative body.
You shouldn't say that praying before Congress is a good thing. My Lord, if we're looking at outcomes, you got to sell this for something better.
Let me tell you, at least they're not fighting it with one another with fisticuffs on the House floor. And
that's
sort of
true.
I mean, it's basically giving reverence to an almighty power, a being that's higher than ourselves.
Wow.
And so I think because we've taken prayer out of schools, I think we've allowed the enemy to come in.
I think as we head to this break, I think the Republican side of the table, I think that they were nodding their heads at that particular point. From coast to coast and border to border, I'm Bruce Dumont. We are looking at 2012 in review and also looking ahead when we come back to 2013, the important issues that are going to define each and every Sunday night discussion here on Beyond the Beltway. We are nearing the end of the year, and we have a great panel of guests on this segment of Beyond the Beltway. Richard Boykin is here. He is former chief of staff to Illinois Congressman Danny K. Davis, veteran Democrat, recently reappointed to the Ways and Means Committee. He is now a partner with Barnes & Thornburg, one of the country's leading law firms. Also joining us, also, by the way, we should mention, you are an ordained minister.
Correct.
And you're a Baptist?
Yes.
Very good. And you preach regularly?
Every chance I get.
Very good.
All across the country.
And also joining us this evening is Stephanie Hitt. She is a wife. She is a mother. She is a graduate of Virginia, of Wellesley, and also the University of Virginia Law School. And once upon a time, she served with Rudy Giuliani in the federal office in Manhattan. And also joining us this evening is Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago. Over 30 years at the University of Chicago, hails from the great city or town or village or hamlet of Marks, Mississippi. Joins us, has been a guest on this program for a couple of decades now. And Mike Miller also joins us. He is one of the newly discovered stars of academia and a regular guest here now on Beyond the Beltway. He is an economist, associate professor of economy, economics, at DePaul University, and a native of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And they are all joining us. And I want to kind of broaden the discussion about, you know, what is likely to be on the horizon next year. And we talked about gun control. We talked about mental health. I mean, realistically, is there anything that government can do, or do you believe there's anything that the president can do to sort of change the cultural world in which we live, the way in which violence has become so prevalent in our motion pictures, in our video games. Is there any encouragement that government can do, or are we going to have to rely on someone in a position of power in the gaming industry or the motion picture industry to wake up and say, you know what, if I perpetually create violent motion pictures, I am desensitizing this country, and I'm raising the likelihood that the country we're going to end up living in is going to result in situations like Sandy Hook, Connecticut. Stephanie?
Well, you know, one of the things I meant when I said earlier is that Obama seems to transcend legislation. He transcends certain politics. And in that sense, he has an amazing opportunity to make cultural statements that aren't necessarily dictates of law. Because, you know, if we start talking about him speaking on movies and content or whatever, we're going to get into First Amendment issues. And I don't think no one's out to abridge the First Amendment. What we're asking people to do in America is to make really good choices. And he can be a leader on that. I mean, he does transcend some of that. And, you know, as our first African-American male president, he has a tremendous ability to relate with, you know, young men who are living in the inner city, for example, who might see a bit of them, you know, themselves in him or vice versa. And I just feel like he has an ability to stand up and say, you know, my role is of being a father, of, you know, of teaching values, of being a prayerful man, and so on. Richard, and the more he does that, the more powerful it is.
Richard, I'm not asking you to reveal confidences that people might have put in you, you know, throughout your week. But the point that Stephanie just made, is that a point that you've heard African-Americans' statements that they've made about maybe a level of disappointment in the president that he has not done more, especially in the wake of this epidemic of murder on the streets in the south and west sides of Chicago?
Well, Bruce, look, the reality is that it took this tragedy in Connecticut, Sandy Hook, as to be a tipping point to get some movement. And I think a number of African Americans feel like, hey, their lives aren't valued as much as white lives. I mean, granted, these were kids, they were first graders, they were young people, but you got kids being killed every week in the city of Chicago.
And this year, a lot more than 26.
A lot more, hundreds.
Right,
I mean, like
hundreds.
400 and something.
There could be 20 in one weekend.
Yeah. I mean, there were 30 shootings a number of weekends. I mean, 6-7 people killed. I mean, and nobody said anything. The mayor said nothing. The governor said nothing. The president said nothing. But, I mean, it's just like, it's oblivious. If it was in, but here's the telltale. When there was violence on the Magnificent Mile and white people were robbed, you saw a massive show of police force, 5 police on every corner. I mean, and so it's like, we're not going to have this on the Magnificent Mile, but we'll tolerate it in the black community, or we'll tolerate it in the Hispanic community.
Mike Miller. That's one reading, and I understand fully how you came to that conclusion, but I guess from my side, the white gentleman's side, and I think one of the losers of 2012 was race politics. The way that almost anything said by a Republican, even the word Chicago, the word professor, by somebody in the media was said, this is a racist dog whistle, and this is a terrible thing for you to be saying. How am I supposed? What if I then said, look at all this killing going on in the black community? What am I going to sound like if I make such statements? Think of even and whether you love him or hate him, Matt Drudge has one of the most popular websites in the world. All he does is link to articles. He doesn't add any except for the headlines. He just links to articles. He was just called a racist because he links to too many black people killing too many black people. And so the problem becomes this race that so many people are afraid to be marked and tarred by the term racism. I can't bring up such things. We were briefly talking at break about one of the biggest problems is the breakdown of the family, where you don't have two parents at home. I was talking to my adult son just yesterday after this horrible shooting, and he was saying, you know, when we were watching these video games, you were there or mom was always there to tell me, no, remember, this is fantasy and this is real. And that kind of influence many years later makes a difference.
I want to pick up on that and state something quite specific. Around 1970, it may have been 1970 actually, Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote a very important and influential report on the breakdown of the black family. He was excoriated. He was absolutely dragged through the mud as a racist. And the result of that is that nobody in academics, courageous we are, wanted to take that on for about 20 years until William Julius Wilson, one of my friends and colleagues at the time at Chicago, now at Harvard, took it on. Himself a black man who was raised in the projects, very distinguished scholar, and he took it on and made it a little bit acceptable. But what Mike is saying about not being able to have a candid conversation. Who asked us for a candid conversation? Eric Holder.
Yes.
Who is the person who absolutely, in the way he has run the Justice Department, thinks that on voting rights, there cannot be discrimination against whites? They have absolutely refused to look at it. So on the one hand, they're calling for a candid conversation. On the other hand, they're absolutely suppressing it. And the issue, but I should just say that the issue of family structure is not something that's confined to the black community, the Hispanic community, or the white community.
Right.
It is a problem all over. And I must say, there are people beginning to address it. And among conservatives, I'm happy to say that the issue of gay marriage has now largely reached the point where you can talk about marriage without it being completely enveloped in the gay marriage issue. And you can just talk about stability of the family.
Yes.
Let me say to that. Let me respond to the distinguished gentleman and simply say this: that when you're in a leadership position, you're mayor, you're white, you're mayor for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When you're governor and you're white, you're governor for everybody.
Sure.
When you're president and you're black, you're president for everybody. To not say anything, to stay silent on the issue of all this violence in the city,
right?
And it's all across the country. Is unconscionable.
I absolutely.
So you're saying that about the president, or you're saying that about Rom?
So I'm saying it about everybody.
I'm saying it about across the board.
I agree with
about
you.
Everybody
I agree.
Absolutely.
I agree. I mean, one of the things is, and we keep talking about this cultural component, is that if we start to break down, and a legitimate, truly intellectually honest commission would do this, is to look at, you know, the victims of gun violence in Chicago, in Newtown. And we would start to see, I think, as you break down the perpetrators and the structures they come from, the issues they go through, the school system they've been through, you're going to start to see a lot of similarities. In the shootings, the mass shootings, we're seeing young white males, many from broken homes themselves, mental health issues.
Mm-hmm. Upper middle class homes in some cases.
In this case, yeah.
But then, you know, you start to look. You know, right. Some of those problems exist maybe in a different way, but you're looking again at a broken family, schools, passed through, cultural effects, whether it's in your neighborhood on the street or in the game in your house. The point is, those are the things that are affecting the people that do bad things.
That's right.
It's not their means. It's what's going in their head.
But there is one set of violence that we do overlook, and we overlook it at our peril, and that's gang-on-gang violence. Mm-hmm. And the only time that really attracts much interest in the newspaper is when gang-on-gang violence kills a six-year-old girl sitting on her front porch.
Right.
So if one gang member kills another gang member, most people and newspaper people just think, you know, hey, good riddance. But if as soon as ordinary people get killed when they're out in their car going through the drive-in or whatever, or as what happened on Magnificent Mile, it was gang violence started on the beach and it sort of continued into innocent area. People really got on it.
Yeah.
We're going to continue our discussion, look ahead to some of the issues of 2013. And when we come back, we're also going to talk about gay marriage. Is it inevitable in this country? 1-800-723-8289. We'll be right back. Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. I asked the question before the break. Is gay marriage inevitable? The Supreme Court's going to take up two cases in 2013. Recently at the polls, Maine and Maryland were added to the list of states that recognize gay marriage, also the state of Washington, I should say. Charles, I'm going to look to you to start this discussion. Is it inevitable? Is the Supreme Court likely to approve gay marriage in 2013?
It's hard to guess what the Supreme Court will do. They're usually 5-4 decisions, and in the case of the swing vote, Anthony Kennedy, he's generally been very open-minded on this particular issue. So if you had to bet, you'd say yes. But let me say something about the way that this issue has developed, because I think it's been very positive. I should say that I'm in favor of gay marriage. The way that it's developed is very different from the debate over abortion. That was a political debate that was cut short by a Supreme Court decision. There was a movement toward wider and wider state-by-state permission to regulate abortion. When the Supreme Court cut it off, it truncated a debate, and I'm glad that they didn't do that, and I'm glad that it didn't end the way it did in Massachusetts with just a one-vote difference on the state Supreme Court. This has been fought out politically. I'm glad it has. It's allowed a political solution to a political problem.
Mike Miller.
Yeah, to me, it's a state issue. I don't. 220 years after the founding of the Constitution, all of a sudden we're going to discover gay marriage. I don't quite see that. But that's why we have states. And I'm a Republican, and I used to have some libertarian leanings. I haven't gotten rid of all of them. And the libertarian leaning in me would say that this is no business of the state. It's between you and your God and whatever, so gay marriage would be fine. But the conservative in me says, you know, societies have been around for now thousands of years, and what have we always done? We've always had a mother and a father, a man and a woman, and that's always been the standard. And I'm not sure we want to throw that out just thinking that this is the way to go. And so couldn't we find something that allows us? But to your question exactly, are we moving that way? Let the states do it like they did not do with the abortion issue, and all of the states are going to do this within the next 10 years.
Not all.
Maybe not Mississippi.
Richard Boykin.
Yeah, I think that the issue, though, becomes if you leave it to the states whether or not it's going to be recognized in another state. And if someone gets sick, if one of the partners gets sick in another state and the partner comes, and then you have a situation where the hospital says, no, we don't recognize that kind of marriage here. No, you can't see them, and they're on their deathbed or something like that. So I think that the court is likely to move towards it. I think the views are changing. Younger people pretty much, they say, hey, let people do what they do. Let's get out of their bedroom.
It will change, and the question is, will it change in 2013? Well, Stephanie?
I don't think it'll change in 2013, and Charles, I'm glad you brought up Roe v. Wade. A few weeks ago we discussed this before, and my prediction is that they will not do what they did with Roe v. Wade. They will let it play out on the political legislative level, the state's level, and they won't make that mistake. And I think, you know, Mike points out.
But they did take the case. Why do you think they took it if they wanted to?
I think that they're going to take it to throw it back, to basically say Prop 8 in California was the will of the people.
Can I ask you a question? I want to take up Richard's point. Could the court say that states have to recognize it across state boundaries but not require Mississippi to?
Because we don't have a case. The two cases they've agreed to take were Prop 8, which was the legislature, the vote. The will of the people. And then the other one was the recognition of the benefits, the estate tax.
Let me just interject here because we've got less than 2 minutes left. And we've talked very generically about what's happening in the world as this program is recorded. But the fiscal cliff is before us. So now look into your crystal ball. You're going to predict what is likely to be happening December 31st, will we go off the cliff, Professor Miller?
I'll put it this way. I hope not. And I think they will come up with something.
Stephanie Hitt, will we be going off the cliff
December 31st? I think we may be, but only for about a month or so.
Charles Lipsom, are we going off the cliff?
If I had to guess, I would guess that we will for a few days. And the reason is I simply think that even though Boehner has caved, the president has escalated his demands.
And the man that has the most congressional experience at the table this evening, former chief of staff to Danny Davis.
I'm going to take the president at his word in the third debate. He said there will be no sequestration. He said that there will be a deal done. I think there will be a deal done.
A deal done. Okay. So that's and we'll all know in less than maybe a few hours,
right,
whether or not you were successful or not.
Yeah.
One last question. We talked about winners and losers of this past year. Give me one name that you want to watch very closely in 2013, Stephanie.
Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton.
I'd say Marco Rubio.
I'd say Ahmadinejad.
Mm.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
And I am going to watch Beyond the Beltway every Sunday night, and I hope that you will as well. Our thanks to Mike Miller and to Charles Lipson and to Stephanie Hitt and to Richard Boykin for joining us tonight on our broadcast. And we also want to thank you very much for joining us each and every Sunday night, both from coast to coast and border to border on our radio show. And for those listening in the city of Chicago who have an opportunity to tune in portions of this program as a television show, we thank you very much. We appreciate your support. Since 1980, we've been with you every single week talking about the important issues. Some of these issues keep coming back again and again. And as we look to 2013, we hope to be able to present to you some solution to some of these problems that we talk so much about. I'm Bruce Dumont. Have yourself a wonderful and happy, healthy 2013. Good night from Chicago.